Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along to the Gallipoli Club tonight, where Geraldine Dugra makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. She's been here, of course, on quite a few occasions before, but tonight on the occasion of the publication of her edited collections, or her book, I'm sorry, The Climb, Conversations with Australian Women in Power. Now, Geraldine Dugra is known well to all of you, I guess, but I'll introduce her briefly. Geraldine Dugra AO is a renowned Australian journalist and broadcaster. She's the host of Radio National's Saturday Extra program and the ABC television program Compass. She's won two Penguin Awards for excellence in broadcasting from the Television Society of Australia and a United Nations Media Peace Prize. This, as I understand it, is Geraldine Dugra's first book, and it's great to have her here tonight to talk on the topic of Reaching for the Summit, Australian Women in Power. Geraldine Dugra, you're very welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed, Gerard. It is a pleasure to be here, I must say. And it's lovely to be here on a topic like this. I brought along, my grandchild stood on my glasses, so they're a bit too warm. I brought along a prop, as one does if one's trained in television, which is the Power edition that came out. And I noticed very few women. I particularly had looked at it and thought, yes, there's not exactly... Many of us there, and often the ones who were there for what I'd call personal growth and advance rather than governing others, which I will sort of suggest to you is what I look for, because I think it's the final frontier. Gaining legitimacy and the privilege of governing others, and that's what I looked at when I did this, came up with this topic, which I pitched to Text Publishing in a fit of rage, I have to admit. I was very angry at the time, last year, after Julia Gillard had stepped down, or been put down, shall we say. It wasn't that I wanted to mount a massive defence of Julia Gillard. I allow actually quite a lot of criticism of her in this book from various people, or significant criticism. But I was furious about some of the discourse that surrounded her, which I really did think was not what would accompany a man. And I just was seething. And I kept waiting, particularly after the Alan Jones comments, which was my personal tipping point, I was waiting for particularly the conservative establishment, in a sense, no matter their political affiliations, to really come out and say, this is a line we mustn't cross. To be traducing a man 3 weeks after his death and accusing his daughter of dying of shame, the man of dying of shame because of the daughter's behaviour, was, to me, so truly shocking that I was left speechless. And I thought particularly for people who care about the maintenance of community codes, which are typically a conservative interest, that there would have been for people who could have easily said, I felt, much more than they did. A few did, but I thought it was, to be honest, rather tepid. I thought there should have been a real outright repudiation of that stepping over the line. I thought it was sort of extraordinarily unkind. I thought it was most discourteous. I thought it was breathtaking, and maybe I was influenced by the fact that I'd lost my husband not terribly long before, and I knew how raw one was, and I couldn't believe that whether or not one felt even vaguely aligned to Alan Jones, because a couple of people have said to me since, well, look, I was never pro him anyway, so I didn't identify it. I said, no, well, fair enough, but where was the sense that there was a sort of a disturbance of a code when that occurred? Where was the repudiation of it? And I wrote in my intro, nothing about her time at the helm was straightforward, and there are widely differing verdicts on her talents. But at the same time, many Australian women and men feel strongly that Julia Gillard was subject to types of discourse and representation that would never have been dealt to a man. For some anti-Gillard warriors, she moved into a category where anything goes, with no need for remorse about tactics. She was merely fair game, and an awful spectacle played out before us, tantalising some, but horrifying most women, I suspect. Among some men, her time in power seems to have activated a form of deep-seated warrior response with distinct overtones of sexual arousal, like the ultimate form of sexual contest. I found it revolting, hardly an inducement for the average woman to enter public life in Australia. And I want them to. I want younger women in particular to feel that it's worth a go. And so I thought, what do I do with this rage? It's pretty useless just being annoyed as far as I'm concerned. I've never taken that view that it's worthwhile, just being super angry. So I decided to try to convert it into something positive, which is what I like in journalism, to look at stories of competence as much as stories of incompetence. I think they're equally valid, and I don't think we do enough of them. And I decided to seek out women who were occupying positions of power across Australia, not just at the big end of town, speak a wide range of arenas from, hopefully, across Australia. And I think I have every state represented except Tasmania, regrettably. I just ran out of time, I'm afraid. So I decided to look for people who weren't necessarily just impressive for personal growth, like I noticed Maggie Beer and Kate Blanchett are in that power and influence index, which is great. But I didn't want people who just palpably grew themselves. I wanted that extra thing, which I think really does in our society confer status and prestige and authority, which is governing others. So I looked for people who were prepared to be relatively candid. I had to push myself into their unbelievable schedules, I might add, and I sort of invariably had about 35 minutes if I was lucky. I asked them all a series of questions, a template of questions. I didn't want to know their entire life story. I wanted to know how they kept themselves in their skin, that great line from Camelot of the Arthur character to Guinevere. How do the ordinary people keep themselves in their skin? How did they keep themselves in their skin, given this very important feature of most research about leadership, which is that people have to make this fundamental psychological shift from being led to being a leader, women and men. But if anything, the research suggests that it's harder for women because women come into communities around them that they know are ambivalent about that psychological shift that they've been forced to make. And so there's a very interesting set of challenges, I think, for women. So I tried to seek people out across a range of arenas who were all governing others now or had just been. And I really, I think, did hear some remarkable stories. I was quite governed, I must say, by Julia Gillard's own words to me at one of those early pink football games out at the stadium, which the Swans played a few years back, which I think we won, which is, you know, a bit rare at the moment. She was in a little group talking to me, and she said, at the end of the day, when I pull up the drawbridge at night, I want to be able to recognise myself. I thought it was a beautiful line, and I sort of use that as a motif to find out whether these women did recognise themselves. And I think all of them did. I think all of them were very comfortable in their skin. Maybe I sought out people who were comfortable in their skin as leaders. A lot of them, because some people had said to me, well, did they nominate their big setbacks? And I said, well, No, they didn't. I didn't dwell on it. I asked for moments when they'd been in a big fight. I'll come to that in a moment. But their setbacks were quite a long time before. And they'd moved past the need to nominate them. Except Julie Bishop, who very interestingly told a wonderful story to me about being an article clerk in the Adelaide Bar, which was her formation ground. And she'd gone in and she had become an article clerk in this particular Adelaide law firm along with a few young men. And on the first Friday, it was announced that the partners would have drinks. They both went down, she and her male colleagues. The male colleague was taken straight into a group of the partners and she was asked to serve the drinks. And she has never forgotten it. And she told me the story. She said, I can't believe I'm telling you this. Why am I telling you this 40 years on? And I said, well, I think I know why you're telling me this. It's still... I think she was incandescent with rage, to be quite candid, and it had still driven her on in an amazing way. But I wanted to hear female stories that other Australian women would recognise. A lot of the material about leadership comes from the US, and a lot of it is quite masculine, even when it doesn't mean to be. It just is, because the incumbents have been males. And so a lot of it, I think, is more solitary than women really seek, ideally. And I think a lot of it is tilting at big windmills, almost sort of grandeur and majesty, which, again, I didn't hear that from any of the women. I'm not saying it's just not there, but I had to be very pragmatic in how much I could ask them and my emphases, given the amount of time I had, and I had to finish the book. You know, I started off when I promoted it to text, and they answered by return email, fantastic idea, start tomorrow, which filled me with dread. And then I knew I had... They initially said there's no hurry, and then they said, yes, there is. Julie Gillard's bringing out a book, and everybody else is too. You better get moving. So I had to really get a wriggle on. So I had to be quite pragmatic. So I didn't follow them down this line of their gigantic, big dreams. I really wanted to write a work that Australian women, and I hope a lot of men recognise, because I think it's very much a commentary on modern workplaces, actually. But I really wanted to write a book that women would say, you know, I can see myself in that. Or, she's quite close to me, but it's not exactly me. You know, I'm not proscribing how people respond, but I wanted it to resemble Australian workplaces and Australian dilemmas, and I wanted the women to recognise their men and their daughters and sons and so on. And I hope I succeed at that. I wanted to tease out questions of power and authority because they absolutely intrigue me, I have to say. So I wanted to, in a way, rebut, I suppose. There's a great line I quote from Germaine Greer, which I heard years and years ago. When all said and done, when women finally got the key to the executive washroom, all they discovered inside was the lavatory. Very, very Germaine. But actually, I don't think it's what... I think the truth is that a lot of people desire that lavatory what they think comes with it. And indeed, I think that it can be an amazing experience, gradually realising your own voice and the power of your own voice, and then making that extra leap into the business of shifting the order of things, which you can do in authority. It's such a wonderful invitation. It's such a wonderful privilege in a society like ours. And I want to see women much more comfortable about offering their talents. But I sense that until we women do work out how we want to divvy up our cup of life energy and distribute it fairly, and I've sort of thought between duty, ambition and joy, that's how I see almost the troika, we won't get there. And we certainly won't have young women following us if we don't look as though we're having any fun. And if we don't look as if there's some resolution to those really pretty big choices. We'll remain ambivalent about ambition unless we articulate the sorts of things that I think these women are articulating. And I wanted a lot of things to be named and to bring them out into the open, because this question of ambition, I think, is really tricky, and I think a lot of women are very ambivalent about talking about it and about naming it for themselves as something that they care about. Now, maybe it's changing among younger women. I went to Annabelle Crabb's book launch this week, and there wasn't actually talk about ambition, talk about surviving, I suppose. It was very interesting for me, who's essentially raised my children, to go and see that next group who are in the middle of raising children and trying to work out how they divvy up duty, ambition and joy. But I suppose I am really fascinated by how women think of the role of ambition in their life, and whether they think they have a right to be ambitious, and whether they think that their talents, sort of great argument that comes through again and again, I have to say, it sounds like a cliche, but it's not, that the research suggests that men put themselves forward for big jobs when they're 40% ready, women wait till they're 110%. And there's a great line from Mark Scott, because I also interview 9 men who are powerful at the moment in our society, and to almost get their sense on the good, the bad and the indifferent of women's rise at the moment. And Mark Scott, my own MD, talks about his wife, Bryony, who, of course, runs now Winona. It's a very prominent educationalist. And she said to him one day, "I am sick to death of women coming before me arguing for their limitations. I'm not going to allow it anymore." And that's a very perceptive remark. So, you know, she'd seek people out to nominate for jobs, and they'd come to the interview panel and tell her why they shouldn't have it. And so he took that as very much a sort of mantra, and he applies it in his work. And I found that a very useful, a very useful thing. Having said that, I don't expect everyone and don't ask everyone to find the leader within. I think that is, frankly, a nonsense, that everyone has got this leadership waiting to come. I think it's a bit of an arrogance that I personally think has been quite influenced by a lot of American aspirational literature. And I say quite definitely that a lot of us might decide they don't want to take or make the trade-offs that these women have made. And they want to be very good followers. And I would love people to feel more confident and satisfied with the role of following very well, rather than believing that the only race that counts or aspiration that counts is that to be a leader. I've watched this over my time in the media sort of gradually creep up. It's almost like that's the way you prove you're a great citizen, is to aspire to leadership. I actually have never thought that, even though I've written a book about female leaders. I think there's hierarchies in talent ranges, and of course often some very, very talented people choose not to take the routes that these women have taken. That is just fine by me. And I quote another line, the marvellous Oscar Wilde line, "Be yourself, everyone else is taken." Which is, I think, another extremely good mantra to live by. But I do admire the bravery that's required to break stereotypes. I think there's tremendous bravery on display among these women, whether it's Simone Wilkie, the most senior woman in the army, learning to shut her mouth and not say the first thing that comes into her mind, whether it's Anne Sherry, just learning to look ahead constantly. She looks 5 to 10 years ahead just constantly in her role at Carnival Cruises. Or whether it's Sue Morfitt, who had the job of downsizing, chose the job of downsizing Pacific Brands. And just before she came in, she'd been there for years, thought she knew the place upside down. She takes on the big job just before the GFC and inherits a complete tsunami of problems. And what she goes through is really quite extraordinary. So what were the patterns I found Well, I found that the family formation, the family of formation of these women was extraordinarily important, more than I think I'd imagined, and I decide more proportionally than a lot of the more sophisticated intervention measures later in, you know, that we all hear about. Clubs are formed and all manner of associations, law society, law firms and so on, to prompt women into roles, persuade them that they should tilt at that windmill. I think the family of formation is absolutely critical. These were all very engaged, very lively families, nothing passive or taciturn about them. They were very in there, for good and bad purposes, I might add. Some of them are pretty character building, shall we say. I noticed, and I've just written a piece for The Australian, which I think is possibly going to be published this weekend or next week, several of them drew back from the final big fight. That really fascinated me. It's almost like that night before battle, when you really got to weigh up how much blood on the floor are you prepared to cope with, how much are you going to continue to wear the results of having done the final assassination, as it were, to quote Paul Kelly describing the Julia Gillard situation. I was quite interested in how several of the women just said, even though they thought they were right for a job and they thought they had it in the bag, and then there was final change in politics, not in just big P politics either, smaller politics, and they just looked, surveyed the scene, were smart enough, become strategic enough to look ahead and thought, it's not worth it. I'll fight another day on my own terms. Most of them sensed they could do better in their public conduct, their speech making, the way they rallied people. And in fact, the research does suggest, quite interestingly, that in the suite of skills deemed characteristics of leadership, there are about 11 usually used. There are increasing numbers. There's an overlap between women and men, but in a couple of areas, women are still seen to be not quite at the level of some men who've had more practice, of course, and that was in throwing the book out and starting again when the problem was so big, a la GFC, that you just had to say, we're in new territory and we've got to start over. And then in drawing your people along with you to that new vision, which is tough, very, very tough. And I don't know how many of you have actually been through that with somebody taking you through a really, through the valley of death. It's incredibly, you never forget it, but as I've witnessed, it does take a lot of the leader. Regulation will suit women. This is something that Max Walsh said to me, which I wasn't quite ready for. He now sort of was very involved in overturning or reforming the Financial Review in the 70s, cut his teeth in the media world, and then is now, of course, in the superannuation industry, where he's working in a very different climate. And he said to me, you know, we're hemmed in for all sorts of appropriate prudential reasons about investing and so on, and you can't go off the reservation too much in the superannuation industry, whereas some of the boys in the wider investment community most definitely do. And he said, I've seen women thrive under those conditions and will continue to thrive, and, which I thought was very interesting. And it certainly conformed to my view, which is that chaos doesn't suit women. Now, a couple of women have come up to me after this, including a couple of my interviewees, who Alana McTiernan and Simone Wilkie, we did at an event in Canberra, and I saw them thinking, and they said, well, we'd like a good crisis. I said, yes, but most, I bet you don't welcome it. And I certainly have, having been at places like Channel 10, you know, where people would say to you, God, it's exciting, isn't it? You don't know when you go out in the morning what you're going to come back to at night. And I said, no, I absolutely hated it. And I wanted to get out of it as fast as I possibly could. I don't think, in fact, I rarely think I've seen women thrive in that particular arena. And finally, I might say that this word wiliness is a very interesting word that pops up again and again in leadership discussions, in people's judgment about what they almost want of a leader. And it's an unusual word, I think you'd agree, because it does sound a little dodgy, that it's a bit duplicitous. You don't know quite where you are with that person. But in fact, quite a lot of the discussion suggests that the wily leader, the person who moves around, who's strong and supple, is really the gold standard. Of course, there's an integrity there. Ideally, there's an integrity, there's a consistency about it. But I do feel increasingly, if you look back through history, you see this phrase or versions of it reappear. And I think it's quite an open question about how women will display wiliness and pull it off, as it were, make it work for them. I think there are various areas. I think there's still quite a lot of work to be done, which is what I wanted to do. I wanted to name some of these areas and have it out in the public conversation, in the hope that young women who accompany people like my son who's about to turn 21 can really feel that there is a more level playing field and that the game is worth the candle. That's my great dream, and I hope you agree when you read it that I might have achieved something of it. Thank you.
Quite a ways.
Thanks for the Glenelg Club as well for providing this fine facilities tonight. So we come to questions and discussion. And as I said, Anne's got copies over there of Geraldine's book, The Climb, Conversations with Australian Women in Power, and I'm sure the author would be happy to sign copies after the event. So we've got until the top of the hour, so we've got plenty of time. You started off by talking about Julia Gillard, and you also quoted that quite interesting anecdote from Julie Bishop. As you're probably aware, in Paul Kelly's book, Kelly makes the point that Julie Bishop was highly critical of Julia Gillard's misogyny speech and felt that the then Prime Minister had totally misread the atmospherics of the Parliament and had misjudged what she should have said. Was this the kind of thing you discussed with Julie Bishop, or how do you end up assessing that kind of division? We're talking particularly about that one speech in the Parliament on that particular day.
Yes, a good question. In fact, I didn't discuss this with Julie Bishop because I cannot begin to tell you what it was like squeezing myself into her schedule. I thought I was there just as the government came in, and I was sitting in her ante room watching all these different groups of people come in, and I thought, will I manage to get to her? I'd flown there specially anyway. She was as good as her word, and she did give me 40 minutes. My own view, and it actually didn't make the final cut, but I think the misogyny was wrong, the word misogyny was wrong, and people like Eva Cox have agreed. I think it's a very powerful word. I think sexism would have been a different word, a completely different set of atmospherics around it, and I didn't always think this. It's funny, in the business of exploring this, because I was so outraged at what Alan Jones thought was vaguely appropriate, that I thought, now, where might I fall into that category? You know, and I eventually decided that it, strangely enough, was around that word misogyny, which I think really, really offended the Prime Minister and his family. And initially I sort of thought, oh, well, you know, it's a tossed off, it's part of the cut and thrust of politics. And then I decided, no, it is a very serious word, and we want to be careful when, this is what Eva said too, careful when we throw it around. I actually quote, there's a very interesting piece in here on Julie Bishop, thinking that you, because I open the chapter on Julie with a commentary from Michelle Grattan, which I think is just quite telling. So this is what Michelle Grattan wrote after that incident. Do you remember that incident when Julie Bishop did the cat's claw to Julia Gillard? And it was sort of very naff, actually, I think. December 2008, tapping into deep-seated stereotypes. So this is Michelle on it. When Julie Bishop made a cat's claw gesture at Julia Gillard in Parliament this week, the shadow treasurer, Julie Bishop, was giving one insight into why she's struggling politically. Bishop explained subsequently, "It's just a little thing that I do," suggesting that perhaps the girls should put the claws away. "It sounded twee," says Michelle. "I was reminded of the comment made by a well-placed observer recently when I was writing about Julia and Julie." This is what the person said. "Gillard can mix it with the boys, Bishop can't. Gillard can cope in a man's world, Bishop is operating in a man's world." And I thought, how different things are now. That Julia Gillard is out of politics and Julie Bishop is, as Bill Shorten said, anyway, best on ground, I think, arguably, and making a very good job indeed of that role. And I know this is a tangent to what you were saying, but one of the things that I decided, having interviewed, so there were several lawyers in this book, Alana McTiernan, Nancy Milne, Julie Bishop, I don't think there's any others, and one doctor, and I found the women with professional credentials, you know, I envied them. I mean, I've got an arts degree with a history major, and I'm very, very grateful for it. But I found that someone like Julie Bishop is utterly fortified by that professional background of hers. She regards it as ballast. And if she turns up at the UN, she just behaves as if she's in a court. She's well briefed. She feels she behaves as an advocate. She feels she's got a right to be there. I think it's a really, it's like an armoury. And I think it's something to remember. Whereas in journalism, you have to reinvent yourself constantly, more or less.
So there's a question down there. Yeah, just Steve. Sorry.
Thanks very much, Geraldine, and thank you to you too for being such a great example for young women across Australia. Now, this is probably $1 million question, but why do you think it is that perhaps women across the board don't tend to exhibit characteristics like wiliness? Is it nature or is it nurture?
Yes, why is it that women don't exhibit wiliness?
Nature or nurture? I've just been wrestling with this in writing this thing today, and I did for this. I feel that women have prized relating and maintaining relationships proportionally more than men. Doesn't mean that there's no clearly prizing of that, but I think that there's been a real premium put on assessing the damage that will be done in ducking and weaving and not practicing it and not practicing in a way the words that follow. I think women have got, my instinct is women have got a revulsion for something that feels vacuous or not full of honesty, and that this is a very tricky area to navigate. And you see, this is the hard part, because I really admire those things. I don't admire duplicity, though I certainly do admire trading and deal-making. I certainly do. You know, I sometimes wonder, what do people think democracy is? You know, it's war without blood. That's what you do. Clever people make trades. Not so that they trade off their integrity, but that's the brilliance. Look at Roosevelt, you know. Look at the people who knew how to actually create links with people with whom they once thought they couldn't deal. So I think women have got to learn this, actually, and do it in their own way. And it just can't be, the switch can't be flicked. I read a very interesting, in that Power magazine, it's a very interesting piece on Angela Merkel that Jeff Kitney wrote. I don't know how many of you read it, but I mean, she's just going from strength to strength in terms of perception. And yet she doesn't appear to do deals, but she clearly does them all the time. She's never been elected in her own right. I didn't quite realise that. So she's always had to negotiate. She's a superb negotiator. And is that wiliness? It's a form of it. That was something that Julia Gillard was very good at. But ultimately, I think she couldn't bring in the rhetoric, strangely enough, that was required to make that absolute move into leadership or that bringing people along with you. I don't think she was very good at that, actually. So it's a work in progress.
Down the back, Robin.
Hi. Thank you for that lovely talk. I'm curious as to why it has to be leadership for followership.
Mm.
And that maybe women want to be more autonomous, and that not only they, but other men as well, should have the opportunity to be more autonomous and to influence by way of intellectual creativity, that rather than by necessarily telling them what people want to do. Maybe that's why women are in small business. Maybe that's why women are in the professions. And maybe Professor Michael Marmot, who said has headed UN Commission on
cardiovascular
arms, makes the point that autonomy, the further you go up the hierarchy, the more autonomous you become, and that's reflected in health. But I'm
okay.
Just wondering if you've got any comments on that.
I mean, do women prefer to be in an autonomous situation rather than part of an organisation, I guess it is.
Yeah, well, look, they may,
but it
won't get them power. Sorry, it won't, in my opinion. In other words, that is exactly what the, as you know, the pattern has been, that women have... and it's still happening slightly lesser extent, just slightly as I understand. So they go up, and then they just reach these limits, and it just drives them mad. Gotcha. And I think one of the very good developments is that they then do what has been, they have had the invitation to get out on their own. You're quite right, and they've made a great success, often on their own. But, oh well, look, I just think that essentially the way the world works, I want women to enter those traditional halls of power. I do. I'm sick of waiting for the side door to matter as much as that main door. And so I sort of put my stake in the ground here, said that.
Question here?
Yeah. Thank you, Geraldine, very much. Do you believe in quotas to at least allow women to get on the ladder?
Yes, I do. I frankly do. And I think sometimes you just have to... I know that business loathes this and it's got, copious answers, why not? And I do... I've got a lovely piece in the men's chapter by John Colvin, who's the head of the... just until very recently, Australian Institute of Company Directors, who, they finally just sort of thought, blow it, we're going to get women in there. They've got it up to about 18.2% of the top 200 companies, I think, of directors. But I just think sometimes you do have to slightly artificially alter the scene. I think they should have sunset clauses associated, by the way. I don't think they should be forever and a day, but I just do think sometimes if you've just got both implicit and explicit discrimination, particularly this implicit, which people don't even recognise, it's this second generation, second string discrimination, which all the literature talks about, can absolutely blindside women. So they're going beautifully, and then they get to a point, they cross over something, and it just hits them like a stone, and they just and a lot of them do just get knocked for six. Well, I and that hopefully, there's a lot of male effort now, like a real institutional effort to break this down, to get into this. It's very impressive what's happening with that male champions of change group that Liz Broderick prompted, but his quotas don't worry me.
Especially,
that was great, thank you. Looking at business more than politics, do you believe that Australian men amongst the business and professional classes are more challenged with dealing with senior women than men in other countries in comparable roles?
Well, maybe I should throw it back to you. I mean, I have heard men, the several key American executives who've been shocked to discover that they were such narrow groups they were entering. I might add, not just women, but diversity in any shape or form. I think Mike Smith is on the record too from the ANZ saying precisely this. I do think it's been... I think the public culture is very masculine in Australia. There's a lot of fun there in that, it's a very robust, humour-ridden culture. But it's... I suspect Australian men are certainly weren't going to roll over easily to somebody coming in saying this is the way to behave. Mind you, I've also spoken to several women from France who say that the impressions given in a place like France is that women are doing terribly well, when in fact it's immensely closed. it's much harder than the general impression is given. I actually think in the UK, which I know quite well, I think it's more open in the UK and the US definitely. So it's particularly why I wanted this to be, you know, observably Australian and not just get the best research, which is, as I said, essentially American. Sandra Levy, for instance, who's head of the Australian Film and Television and Radio School at the moment, was a very big creative person over all her life and was head of television at the ABC. She was enticed at almost the peak of her power to go across and work for Kerry Packer at Channel 9 as head of drama. And as soon as she got there, Kerry had gone, actually, she discovered she was in, she thought, an absolute zoo. You know, she was in total boys' land, and I know that land, and it's exceptionally, the whole tone and tenor is, it's extremely difficult if you're a woman, unless you are ready to play it very much by the boys' rules. They're very talented people and they're very effective, but it's just a totally different tone. Now, these days, you see, I just think it's not worth it. Like, I thought it was when I was younger. I just now think it robs you, crushes you. And she got out after 5 months and she felt humiliated. She thought, what a mug I've been. And then had to get herself back into some sort of decent job. So I think it is pretty challenging in Australia.
So there's a question here. Yeah.
Geraldine, when you opened that issue of the film review, I did last week, what was your response?
Oh, I was a bit bewildered. I was a bit not, I have to honestly say. You know, I know that it's the definitional thing, how you describe power and influence. I applaud the idea and effort to explain power and influence and to really put words to it. I love all that, but it just did seem same old. I really did think that. Actually, Boss magazine tries very hard, if you're in the fit, to really look for different models of leadership, female leadership, very admirably, in my opinion, and to articulate them and to imagine that what prestige might amount to in more than the usual terms. And, of course, the Finns just done this 100 women of influence. Mind you, I did notice that a third of those women had nominated themselves. Which was an intriguing little observation. So we've got a way to go, and as I said, I really believe things are altering. I really, really do. And if you could have seen these women, this younger bunch of women at the Annabelle Crabb thing the other day, with kids running everywhere, you sort of sensed that these women did have a bit of a sense of entitlement, in the best sense of the word. You know, they were outraged things weren't there. Aren't they fixed?
Yeah. And, well, at least the Women's Weekly did have Julie Bishop as number one, whereas the Finn Review didn't even mention her.
That they did not. You're quite right.
Unbelievable.
And in a way, you know, Annabelle had made that sense of going that step further and looking at, because she's such a fresh, you know, she's such a clever journalist, looking at flexibility for men, saying, this is the next frontier. I couldn't agree more with her.
Question down there, yeah.
I don't want to give any more time to the financial review powers. One of the women, I guess she's the editor,
yeah,
had a very snide comment that neither Peter Fredman and Catherine Livingstone, who in fact got the tuna's power, did not sit with their own photographs. Now, it is not that the AFR would not have had more stock photographs of them than possible. I'm not sure it was necessary to make that point at the front of the whole issue and denigrate them.
So the gist is in the financial review power issue, Peter Cradle and Catherine Livingstone did not pose for their own, the fresh photographs.
Mm.
That's the suggestion.
Yes, I've got it here. Katrina, who comes on my show once every 6 weeks, so I'm going to be careful what I say about Katrina, and talks about
so Katrina
arts.
Is the editor.
Katrina Strickland is the editor, and you're quite right, she said that a further point, we sought to commission portraits of the women on our overt and covert power lists, which are very male-dominated. However, the two contenders, Peter Predlin and Catherine Livingston, did not want to be photographed. That's their right, of course, but in light of recent debate about the representation of women in the business media, it strikes me as a lost opportunity.
Right, but they already had
it covered. Yes, I hadn't read
your... Someone like Peter Credlin, I mean, if she's the Chief of Staff of the Prime Minister, if you go and pose for the power issue, it looks like you're making a grab. I mean, she is only a political staffer. It's very hard for her to pose for a photograph. But what would I
Would that be the advice you'd give her?
I wouldn't need to give her advice. But if she asked me, I'd say, don't do it. Because if you do pose, then you're told you're pushy and upwardly and whatever else. Well, I'd give the same advice to a mouse. I mean, Julia Gillard's male media advisor didn't do her a lot of good with all the publicity he got.
John McTiernan.
I mean, disaster.
Yes, these choices and the way they're perceived, I don't know why it was commented on.
I mean, nobody else would have even noticed that.
No. Plus, so why...
Why did she choose to make that when they argued you too much powerful women?
Look, I think the truth is that we women... I think what happened with Julia Gillard is that... I think it is churning around in our heads, you know? I think we are still immensely challenged and captivated and preoccupied by all the various ramifications of it. I don't think it's gone away. I'm not suggesting we think about it as much as we did, but I think a lot of us who, you know, try to think about these things, I certainly do, are just fascinated by all these different little decisions and how they're perceived, you know, and, you know, how Tanya Plibersek comes across on Q&A, you know, and how somebody else comes across on the drum, and whether somebody cares to, you know, stand there with their hand on their hip, you know, hip and look, you know, attempt to look sexy sort of thing, and will that sort of undermine their perceived authority, you know? I think it is so fluid at the moment, and representational politics is so much the go, that I just think we've got to live through this, and in a way encourage women to be, well, I want them to be savvy and strategic, but to find their own voice. I just don't think there's any greater power than finding your own voice. Then you can do the wily adjustment. But you've got to be encouraged to find that voice of yours. I think, you know, when I moved to Life Matters after years and years of being on News and Current Affairs, where I really did play by the boys' rules, I suddenly found my own voice, in my opinion. And I don't think in a way, you know, I think that was a tipping point in my career.
Discussion down there? Yes. Yes.
Geraldine, I think you've just answered my question in a sense. You talk about all these other powerful people you have written about. You are a very powerful woman in your own right. At what stage of your career did you feel you had that certain power on the lifeline? Is that where you felt you came from a very different career than Bishop and many others? So, through the media.
The suggestion is that you're a powerful woman, so when did you feel that you were such? Thank you, John. That was the question. That was the question. That was the question.
I think that there was a moment about 5 years into Life Matters, which I can remember. So Life Matters, you know, Joe Upham and I created that show. It's now 22 years old. It's been through different iterations. It is the proudest thing I've done in my career, Life Matters, because I do think it shifted the agenda. And when I was offered the job by Swan to come to Radio National, my husband at the time, you know, my then husband, my now deceased husband, said to me, well, what are you taking that for? You're going to a woman's ghetto. And I said, well, that's where I want to go. Thanks very much. I know that's what we all talk about, and I'm sick of worrying about whether I'm beyond the ghetto or in the ghetto, and it was an incredibly important decision. But I can remember, so I thought we really created something special. And I remember that a journalist from the Bulletin, whom I won't name, actually came and did, well, I think we were 4 or 5 years in, I thought we were really doing well, and I thought we'd made a program about the politics of change, the politics of
changing families, etc., etc. And she came along and did a piece, and she basically said something like, this is a show, it was wittily written, this is a show about children and families, and the sorts of choices that people make in their day-to-day lives. And I looked, I thought, not, that's what we moved from. That was the show that preceded us, which we moved out of. And I was completely and unreasonably affected by this woman's judgment, having been so much less than I thought it would be. You know, I thought she'd really write this bigger agenda. And I was furious. And then I realised how stupid that was. What a waste of energy. And how juvenile it was to be so caught up in someone else's judgment in a sort of short column about a program. And I just thought, I'm never again going there. I know what we're doing. I know the feedback we're getting. I know who we can invite on the show and who comes on. And I actually think, looking back, you've just forced me to think, I think it was an incredibly important moment. I thought, I'm just running my own race, thanks very much. I'm not going to worry about what others say unless they're head of the ABC or something. And, you know, that's the great joy of being live to air. You're very powerful unless you make a mistake. So you're careful. But I think that's when it happened. So that was, what, mid-90s or 97 or something.
Right down the back.
I was very interested in your comment about chaos and how women are not comfortable with chaos. In the kind of world that I see at the moment and looking to emerging businesses ahead, I think it's going to be a marvelous world. So were there any lessons in the stories of the women and men you interviewed that could be shared with the young people?
Any lessons about how women might feel comfortable in a state of chaos?
Well, I think that we will have a great deal of... I think the change will be constant. Jeff Kennett said this at a lunch that I attended years ago in Brisbane. You know, he said, we're going to have chaos for 30 years, and I thought it was really Jeff. You know, being, this was in the 90s, but I think Jeff has been more right than I was. And Sherry's chapter, I think, is required reading about... managing chaos and enjoying crisis. I actually think she's one of the genuine people who uses crisis to good effect. She was I think she's a very natural, I call her the natural. And she actually has this very interesting, she had this line that, like, she had all sorts of things about when, you know, that young couple who drowned after they went over the Carnival Spirit and, you know, on their honeymoon, for God's sake, you know, could you imagine anything more ghastly? And she had to sort of set up effectively a crisis room and an unthinkable tragedy. And she says here, some of that cool-headedness I learned from my years in government through all sorts of things and with some people who are very good at being clear about how you manage public messaging. I think there's a skill there that I probably have learned over time, but there's a focus you need to have. When you've got something you've got to do that's fundamental to the whole business, but which also is so important personally for those families, you just have to clear your desk of everything else. Anything that was on that day is gone. You actually go into another space. You get out of your usual work environment and go into what we call the emergency ops room. Everyone's concentrating, sitting around the table and whiteboards. We're very clear about what we've got to do. There's a discipline regarding those things, and that serves us very well, and that environment served me very well. And I won't go on, but I said, because it was quite revealing, I sort of thought, oh, but I know I'd instantly say, but what, do I stay back late and finish those things? And I threw off the diary. And I said to her, well, what happens to those things? She said, I don't know, you know. I said, well, do you ring someone else? A minion picks them up, you know. And she said, they're dealt with, but that's not my problem for the moment. I have got bigger things. I found it incredibly helpful that she really saw that ability to cut through, and I mean, that's exactly what all that research says, that this is when you just say, right, this is what they call transformational leadership as opposed to transactional leadership, which is where women tend to do very well, and so a lot of men, but a lot of women, you know, making sure they brief the team and bringing the team along. But that business of saying, we're in an emergency ops room, and we're probably likely to be here for 2 weeks, I think that's what young women should read about.
Okay, and right to the end, there's a question there and a question over here. Oh, we'll take one question here and one over there. Got to be quick. Yep.
Yes. How well do you think women empower and mentor the younger women coming through?
How well are women empower mentoring younger women?
I asked all of them that, and most of them were quite consciously mentoring younger women, and trying to be imaginative, trying to invite them to step up. I wonder, because I didn't see them happening, I wonder like how much you actually... it's quite a tricky thing with young women, because I've been through it myself, where you actually have to be quite firm in what they're not achieving at the time. So I said to one young woman recently, you haven't won the argument with me, you know. You've put it, but you've not won it. She looked at me and I said, well, you've got to win these arguments. It's no use just describing them. And I fundamentally believe that you've got to be prepared to both give out information that's difficult and ask for it, I might add. And Anne Sherry does that extremely well. She very cleverly asks for impressions of her behaviour at the board meeting, which I think a lot of us think, oh, no, I won't, you know, something's gone wrong, I won't ask my colleagues what happened there. But no, they really were. They were very consciously trying and doing it personally and sort of systemically.
Another question there.
In terms of political power, there was a time when, in Sydney, every layer of political power was female. The mayor, the premier, the governor, general, the governor, the prime minister, the even queen. Now we have one woman in parliament, one woman in cabinet.
The suggestion is there was a time in New South Wales where all the positions of power were held by women. Mm.
Yes, they were. And I never took that. I was thrilled, but I never took that seriously. I can tell you, I didn't think there'd be one woman in the ministry, in cabinet. But I just think it shows that. Look, there's always going to be ebb and flow. You can't be too puritanical about it. But I just think that. You look at that critical mass, that thing. Gloria Steinem, you know, said this to me many years ago on Radio 2UE. This vision came in and did this interview with me. I've never forgotten it. And that was back in 1986. Gloria Steinem came out to Australia, and I did this interview with her. And she said, critical mass is everything. One or two women, not her. It's critical mass, and I've never forgotten it. Because that changes, it just changes, I think it certainly changes women's confidence, but I think it changes everything. And I do see critical mass in quite a few areas of the ABC, for instance, which I think do make it very amenable to women. But we can't relax until that's more evident.
Jordan, many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.